Sorry, let me just get familiar with this computer quickly. Here we go. All right. Thank you again for being here. My name is Will Lowers, and so I'll be walking through the straw proposal that we have today. I'll do my best to be fairly deliberate and slow going through the slides, so please bear with me. But I think it's important to make sure that we cover all of the details as we go through it, just so that everyone's on the same page as we leave the room today. So for an overview, we'll be going through the background. We'll be going through eligible resources as we see them in the program. Clean peak windows, clean peak certificate multipliers, program metrics, targets, requirements, and impacts, and then our anticipated implementation schedule. So just for a quick background on the Clean Peak Standard, as the commissioner mentioned, Governor Baker first proposed the Clean Peak Standard last year, and it ended up passing through the energy bills of last year. And so the statute that passed actually includes some fairly definitive language, so we'll go through how that has guided our shaping of what types of eligible resources will be in it, what the windows will be, and what the program really represents from a participation perspective, and then also from an obligation perspective. So Clean Peak resources will include new Class 1 renewable energy resources, existing Class 1 and Class 2 resources that pair with new energy storage. It will include energy storage systems with certain qualification requirements, and then it will include demand response systems. And any system that is eligible and qualified that then dispatches energy during a clean peak window will be eligible to generate clean peak certificates. And so those certificates will be sold to retail electricity suppliers, which will have a minimum obligation established for them, very similar to our other portfolio standards such as RPS and APS. So I think it will be very familiar for those organizations. And DOER, we are responsible for establishing the eligibility criteria, establishing the actual periods which will represent the peaks, setting the scale and structure of the program, so setting the alternative compliance payment rates, which is a cost cap for the program, and the process for verifying and minting certificates, and then establishing the compliance requirements. So for a brief background on our objectives, our goal is to align clean energy generation and demand response with periods of peak electricity consumption. And as the commissioner mentioned, there are multiple benefits associated with that objective. So as part of that, we are seeking to further encourage the co-location and cooperation of energy storage with clean generation. And we are looking to incentivize the continued deployment of renewable resources by flattening the net electric curve. So starting to get into the program design details background, the structure will be, again, that any qualified resource will be eligible to generate the Clean Peak certificates. So this will be a certificate-based program as currently proposed, which I believe, again, you'll be familiar with from RPS and APS-type programs. That sub-bullet is important here. Dissimilar from an RPS, where a certificate represents 1 megawatt hour of energy, and more similar to our APS, because there are not external trading programs that have to have the same equivalency to this, and because we are nation-leading, we can establish multipliers in this program. So there is an opportunity, similar to an APS, where we have multipliers to incentivize by technology type. There may be multipliers that we'll get into further on today to incentivize operational profiles or other. The minimum standard obligation will be applied to all retail electricity suppliers, and will be set as a percentage of total retail sales. That would be total of retail sales across the entire year, not retail sales within the peak window. That should help with clarity and ease of standing up the program because it's something that retail electricity suppliers are very familiar with today. So one of the goals is maintain as much simplicity as possible as we roll this program out. So I believe that will help support that objective. Part of the statute did identify that the annual obligation must increase by at least 0.25% every year. So that is a statutory requirement as we structure the program. Retail loads served under contracts that were executed prior to January 1st of this year are exempt from the obligation. So there will be a sort of relatively low obligation early on, as a lot of electricity is already under contract. And then as new contracts come into play, we'll see more and more of the electric load falling within the requirements of this program over the course of probably just a couple to a few years. And then alternative compliance payments, similar to our other portfolios, create a cost cap to the overall program and help to establish a market value for the certificates. So now getting a bit further into the details. For eligible resources, the statute identified that there will be four types of eligible resources. New RPS Class 1 resources that enter into operation on or after January 1st of 2019. Existing RPS Class 1 and Class 2 resources that pair with new energy storage, so the energy storage needs to enter operation on or after January 1st, 2019. Qualified energy storage systems, which include standalone systems and incremental pump storage capacity, but further on we'll get into what the term qualified means in this instance. And then demand response resources. Following a set of our questions and the stakeholder responses we received, we are currently considering that distribution connected resources would have a requirement to be interconnected within the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and to the Commonwealth's electric power system, and that transmission-connected resources would need to be connected within the ISO New England control area. So, providing just a bit more detail on each resource type, for new RPS Class 1 resources, excuse me, so again, January 1st of this year is the entering into operation date for eligibility. And upon qualifying for the Clean Peak standard, all electricity that they deliver during the seasonal peak periods will be eligible to generate CPCs. And it's worth noting that the statute makes clear, that during the seasonal peak period, the resource will generate both whatever RECs it's otherwise eligible to generate, as well as clean peak standards. So this is incrementally additional to that. For eligible resources, existing Class 1, Class 2 renewables that pair with storage. So again, the statute identified that existing resources that now add storage after January 1st will become eligible to participate. Again, we asked some questions specifically about this in an attempt to provide at least a meaningful threshold. And so we're currently proposing that the storage would need to represent at least a 25% of the nameplate power of the RPS resource and have a minimum 4-hour duration for the storage. And the thinking here is the storage needs to be sufficiently sized that it's making a meaningful difference in the output of that facility. Because as the next statement mentions, upon qualifying, all electricity delivered by that resource during the seasonal peak period will be eligible to generate CPCs. And so the objective behind those thresholds would be to prevent, say, a very large resource, or a relatively large resource, a 10-megawatt resource, pairing a residential energy storage system and getting that entire 10 megawatts of capacity to generate clean peak certificates. So we need some form of threshold to show that there's actually a meaningful change in the output. So onto qualified energy storage systems. So the statute, again, provides some clarity for us as to what we're working within. We're using the same definition for energy storage as already exists in statute. It has a very similar requirement for entering into operation January 1st of 2019, and it can be a new resource or incremental additional capacity to a resource. And on the term qualified, the statute requires that the system operates primarily to store and discharge renewable energy. And so that will be one of the key decision points on determining what is a qualified energy storage system. And we'll get further into that as well. On demand response resources, the statute, again, provided a definition for us. And the definition included basically any change in usage or consumption patterns as a response to a price signal. Whether it's demand charge, time of use rate, wholesale rates, or otherwise. And so thanks to some of the comments that we received, we've identified that for all technologies, but it's specifically applicable here, we must be able to measure and verify the reduction in energy or load in order to be able to verify and mint certificates for that operation. As currently considered, it would be possible for aggregations of multiple technologies in multiple locations to participate. We are currently considering where demand response resources would need to be connected to the distribution system in Massachusetts. And as currently envisioned, demand response resources may include energy storage, electric vehicle charging, and all other responsive electric loads, which can be measured and verified. So now getting a bit more into the program structure. So the statute tasked the DOER with defining the seasons for clean peak windows. And again, we opened for comment and received a great variety of comments on this. And so one of the suggestions that we really appreciated was attempting to match the clean peak seasons with typical weather conditions of Massachusetts, which often drive our load profile and what our peak conditions look like. And so we're currently proposing the windows that you see below, where spring would be March 1st through May 14th. So it's shortened a bit in May, because typically the latter half of May can start getting very hot and have very summer-like days and summer-like peaks. Summer would be May 15th through mid-September. Similarly, early September, we often have relatively hot days that are much more representative of a summer peak day than a fall peak day. Fall would be September 15th through November 30th, and winter would be December 1st through February 28th. So now getting into the clean peak windows. So each season will have a set hours of the day, which will represent the clean peak windows. And again, this is by statute. And by statute, every season must have a minimum of 1 hour of peak window and a maximum of 4 hours. So that is sort of what we are working within, the structure we're working within. So our intention is to establish the periods no less than a year in advance of when they'll be applied. One of the objectives is for there to be relative market certainty so that participants understand what types of operations they can expect to receive what types of incentive in out years. And we would propose to do that at the same time as establishing the annual minimum standard percentage requirement for the retail electricity suppliers. We intend to review and potentially revise the peak periods at least once every 3 years. So as our load profiles change, as our generation profiles change, the needs and the optimum benefit to the program may change what windows would best represent them. So the balancing act is how frequently we review the program to try to maximize program effectiveness, while at the same time understanding that we believe the market would like to see relatively consistent and relatively longer periods of certainty for when their operations will actually generate the certificates. We anticipate the periods will be established in guidelines so that we will not be going through a full rulemaking process every time the program needs to be changed. And as I mentioned, they must be at least 1 hour and no more than 4 hours. And we're currently looking at primarily weekdays, excluding holidays, as for the peak windows are applied against. So now, getting a bit into a bit of context for why this program exists and sort of what are some of the values that we're going after. If you look at the right-hand side with the three charts, all three of these charts are across a full year. So the x-axis is a year, and on the top chart, the y-axis is our daily energy spend in electricity. The middle is a few different emissions profiles from our electricity generation sector. And then the bottom chart is our daily peak demand in megawatts. So these just give a sense of relative scale and order of magnitude between the seasons. So you can see on the spend, there are some very high on the left in the winter days. I don't think that's a surprise to anyone that there have been very expensive winter events. And then it drops very strongly down for spring, where our energy system is far less strained and we have substantially less load. Increases again in summer, where it can be very hot, and again we have very high load. Can drop and fall, and then rise back up in winter. So really emphasizes winter and summer. Similarly, for the emissions, you see the dips in spring and fall, and you see the relative higher in winter and summer. And those are overall emissions. It's worth noting that the actual emissions per megawatt hour in winter are substantially higher than in the summer. And then in the bottom, it shows the absolute peak, just highlighting, again, winter and summer are the two higher periods, with summer being the highest. So we have looked at past data for Massachusetts load profiles and identified the following as initially proposed periods for clean peak windows. Excuse me, I'm sorry about that. So we're currently looking at split peak windows in the winter, spring, and fall, where we would have a one-hour window in the morning and a three-hour window in the evening. That is in part because our current net load in those three seasons really does show a fairly drastic two peaks of the day. There's the morning peak, a fairly substantial reduction midday, and then a fairly substantial peak again in the late afternoon. And a lot of that, not all, but a lot of it can be attributed to solar PV production masking the load. And we are working with the net load, so again, we are working with the load profile that is masked by solar. So those mornings are intended to address some of the morning. And then you'll notice summer is a bit earlier in the day and entirely blocked in one broader peak. So now just to go through some of the data sets that we looked at that resulted in those windows. This shows winter. The dots that you'll see, the points on the chart, represent the actual daily peak for the past 6 or 7 years. And you'll see that in winter, it's very consistent. Those 2 hours in the evening almost always represent the actual peak of the day. So good news, it is very likely that the window that we establish will actually reduce the peak on just about every given day of the winter. We are starting to see a lot more days where we do have a morning peak and an evening peak. So we do currently have proposed a morning window as well to start to address that. The blue line represents a fairly typical winter day. So this would be most days of the winter you'll see a profile like that. And then that green profile is a more substantial cold day. And I believe that was actually a very cold day where we had actually seen some snow the night before. So we saw a lot less of that dip in the middle of the day. But the good news is the windows that we're currently looking at would address both types of days. So really the window should be beneficial just about every day. Spring can be a lot trickier. And one thing to note, though, between the winter and the spring is these are on the same scale. So they both have, I think, 26,000 megawatts as the very top of the chart. So you'll see they're a lot lower. The peaks in our load is generally much lower in the spring. We have much less consumption, a lot less heating demand, a lot less HVAC and associated load from the heating. It's starting to get lighter out, so we don't have as much lighting or as many hours of lighting runtime. But because of that, the load profile of the day can start to change substantially. So we start seeing peaks spread out a lot throughout that midday window. Again, we do see a lot of these split peaks, where there's a morning peak and an evening peak. So we are currently proposing to address going after that. And we're also starting to see in spring a shift of the peak later into the evening and further down in the evening. So maybe later this evening when you have access to the slides, you'll notice the dots that represent 2018 tend to be shifted to the right and down relative to many of the years before that. And a lot of that can be associated with increased solar production, further masking the peak and pushing it further out and down. Looking to summer, you'll know these peaks can be substantially higher than what we've seen in the others. And they're also much broader. It's a much more single curve to the day. And it's much earlier in the day. And a lot of that has to do with a lot of our electric load kind of fighting the sun and the heat of the day in the summer. So while buildings are trying to stay cool toward late afternoon after they've been baking in the sun, the HVAC is working a bit harder. Homes are starting to pre-cool for people to get home. So a little earlier in the day, we start seeing our peak loads, even with the amount of solar production that we have. So to address that, the window here is all at once to address that very broad window, and it's a little early in earlier in the day to target the majority of peaks, but also go after the highest peaks. Because again, the objective here is to flatten the load profile from a daily perspective, but also to reduce those true peaks, the absolute peaks, that can really have substantial emissions and other ratepayer impacts. And then as we transition from summer to fall, we start seeing that split again, where the green line represents, we see some fairly warm days that look a little bit more like the summer. However, they look a bit more masked from the solar because it's not as hot and the sun is still producing pretty well. So that green line is a fairly masked but pretty hot fall day. And then the blue line is a pretty typical weekday in the fall. So again, we're going after a split. We do see that morning peak starting to become more and more prevalent as part of the flattening the load curve. But then also the evening peak, there's a matter of selecting which of those primary lines that we're going after with an overall objective, again, to try to capture the relative highest peaks while also capturing the majority of daily peaks. So just a bit of background on those slides and those windows. We've been looking at ISO New England shares some great data sets on their website, including load profiles by 5 minute and by hour, going back multiple years, by load zone, so you can just sort in Massachusetts. This goes through what we've just discussed, where winter was very predictable and very consistent. Summer was fairly predictable, but a fairly broad window that we're going after. And spring, again, was not very predictable at all, but also those peaks that they represented were relatively low. So now transitioning a bit into clean peak certificate generation. So we're currently proposing that and you'll note that every season represented 4 hours as currently proposed. So the current proposal would be every window would be that maximum of 4 hours of allowable window. So for generation, we are looking at a facility generating clean peak certificates based on their average output over the duration of the seasonal peak period for a given day. So if it's a weekday and the window applies, the average output of the facility over the 4 hours which are within the window would determine the number of certificates generated. Separately, we are proposing to include on the day which has our regional peak demand, the performance of the resource on that actual hour of peak demand would also be used to generate additional clean peak certificates. And the objective there is to make sure that the resources participating here do have a reason to try to reduce the actual peaks in a given month, because we are limited to multi-year horizon forecasts of the load shape, and while beneficial for flattening the load profile, the actual absolute peaks will still be present and is still something that would be valuable for these resources to help address. And then as proposed, the clean peak certificates will be minted following the receipt and verification of the performance for the month. So we are currently envisioning every resource would be required to submit their full hourly interval data for the preceding month, and we would have a centralized verification look at that hourly data set, apply against just the actual production within the peak windows, and determine the number of clean peak certificates generated by by that resource. So as I mentioned earlier, there is an opportunity here for multipliers, which is a great flexibility to have in a program design, because it enables us to better highlight where resources are providing the best value. And this is an alternative to, we noticed some stakeholder responses proposing that spring and fall maybe be lower valued by only having a single hour of peak window. And that would be a way to provide a policy signal to which windows are the most valuable. And I think we've landed instead on proposing those 4 hours of window so that we're still really trying to address the entire load shape, but then using multipliers as an alternative way to send signals to the relative values of seasons. So diving into current multipliers that we're considering. As part of the core design, so multipliers that I think we are very comfortable with and we do believe very likely to be rolling out with this first iteration of the program, are a seasonal multiplier, so having multipliers against all windows in the spring, summer, fall, winter, where each season would have its own multiplier. That way we can value the relative impact of this program by season. Having a multiplier for the actual monthly system peak contribution by resources. So again, if performance on that actual 1 hour is more valuable than performance on any other given hour within our window, we may use a multiplier to signal that. And then a few other multipliers that we are currently considering as a policy enhancement, which as of today, again, we have a fairly tight turnaround for the rulemaking process, drafting regulation, and promulgating regulation. We are, again, as all regulations are, balancing time, simplicity, and effectiveness. And so these may represent enhancements, but they also may add complexity. So that is currently part of the consideration. Potential for a resilience multiplier, which would send a signal that systems which may be able to supply electric service to load in the Commonwealth during a broader outage may have a higher value and so may receive a multiplier for their performance in the program. A potential minimum load negative multiplier, where in certain seasons we may be reaching saturation points or periods where renewables can't easily and readily be integrated into the system. And so there's a potential for a negative multiplier during some of those windows, which would send the signal to store that generation or design a system that really prioritizes generation outside of those windows. And that would help send the signal to dispatch technologies which enable the continued integration of renewables through the Commonwealth. And then finally would be a distribution circuit multiplier where we could involve our electric distribution companies where they have further insights into locational values for these resources and where their distribution circuits may be reaching certain capacity thresholds or other thresholds where these resources, by participating in our windows, would actually benefit them as well. So diving a bit into these, on the seasonal multipliers, as we noticed with the chart that kind of compared over the course of the year, summer and winter kept rising as really core seasons for emissions, for cost, for system strain, for relative scale of peak. So we are currently considering the summer and winter to have a similar multiplier to each other. As currently drafted, we have it at a 3x, both for summer and winter. And then we have spring and fall at a 1x. So just giving a relative order of magnitude here of prioritization of what seasons a resource may participate in. And again, it would be up to the resource to determine its operating scheme and when it is charging, discharging, or dispatching, or generating. But this would help give them a variable price signal so that they're really trying to perform in the seasons where we see the highest value for them to perform. On the actual system peak multiplier, because all of the minting and verification is after the fact, so resources all have submitted their data, a centralized verification is happening. At that point in time, we also know when the actual peak of that month was. So there's also an opportunity to assess the performance of each resource against the actual peak that occurred in the month. And it's worth noting that actual peak may not occur in the window that we've established. Again, we are going to do our best with the data that we have at hand, but we are in a changing landscape. And so this is an opportunity to make sure whether or not we have accurately caught the actual peak, there is an incentive for participating resources to have addressed that peak in some way. As currently considered, we have, you'll note, a 15x on it. That may stand out compared to what we just saw with the 3 and the 1. But it's worth noting that that 3 and 1 would apply against every hour of those 4-hour windows for every weekday of a given month, whereas this multiplier is applying to 1 hour that happens on one day of a given month. So even though the multiplier is substantially higher, the actual relative share of program value associated with this versus associated with your daily dispatch is worth taking into consideration. And again, this would be a retroactive application. And as currently considered, all multipliers would apply. So the actual system multiplier would be subject to if other enhanced policy mechanism multipliers may be in effect, or if seasonal multipliers were in effect, they may be multiplied here. Getting into some of the considerations on some of the policy enhancement multipliers, as the Commissioner noted, one of our objectives is to improve the energy resilience of the Commonwealth in the future. And one potential aspect of that could be for resources that are incentivized in our policy and programs to be incentivized to be configured and operated in a way where they are technically capable of providing electricity to load during an outage, whether it's a distribution outage, a broader regional outage, or otherwise, there is value in loads being served. So this is a potential multiplier that would help to send that signal so that as developers and customers are considering enrolling in this program, they would be considering their energy resilience as a component of their participation. To the topic of a potential negative minimum load multiplier, we've started seeing periods where the daytime minimum load actually drops below the nighttime minimum load. It happened for the first time in ISO's history last April. We've actually had it happen a couple times already late this winter, so this is expected to be a more and more common occurrence, especially as we continue to integrate more renewable resources onto our system. And a lot of the challenges associated with continuing to integrate renewables, particularly intermittent solar, are associated with these discrete incidents where we have the absolute minimum loads during the day. So they are limited time periods, but they limit the overall capacity of renewables that we can add to the system. So this program may be one opportunity to help to address that, where we would be sending a signal not to export during those periods, not to shed load during those periods, but instead have a negative multiplier. So you are incentivized to charge or to consume or to disincentivized to export. So again, it's a concept that really has started to be considered elsewhere as a reverse DR type concept, but it's under consideration here at least. And then on distribution circuit, the distribution system represents a fairly substantial capital investment, and it, like the entire rest of the system, like generation, like transmission, is sized for the peak demands that it will see, that it's projected to see. So reducing peak demands can reduce the need for upgrade of systems and equipment that otherwise has remaining service life. So if this program can help to send price signals to help defer, mitigate, delay those otherwise not required upgrades, that would be to the benefit of all ratepayers in the Commonwealth. As of right now, I believe we would consider this just to be a multiplier of one, and it would be something that we would need to work very closely with the owners and operators of the distribution system to identify how we would incorporate a multiplier, but it could be at least a placeholder so that the opportunity exists. So we'll walk through some brief examples of how we foresee the certificates being generated. In this example, at least, it's a winter day, weekday in January. The windows include a morning hour and 3 hours in the evening. The day does not represent the actual peak. And then in the table, We have the system's average performance for each of the hours that were applicable. The average of its performance over those 4 hours is that 83 kilowatts. So that 83 kilowatts is what will then be used to determine the number of certificates that resource is eligible to generate. So further below shows an example calculation where it would be the certificates is equal to the average production over the window times the seasonal multiplier, in this case winter, which as proposed right now, around about 3, times the number of hours of peak window. So there were 4 hours of peak window. So then the next bullet shows that that math being the 83 times the 3 times the 4 hours is 1,000. And so it was in kilowatt hours. Just to convert to a megawatt hour equivalency, that would be one clean peak certificate generated by that resource on that day. And then just to provide an example of what it would look like if it were the peak load day of the month. I believe this is a very similar, it is a winter day with the 4 hours, similar eligibility for multipliers, similar performance, and then the actual peak of the entire month occurred in that 5 to 6 p.m. window. And so in this case, the number of certificates the resource is eligible for is the same as before, but then in addition, it's eligible for its performance against the actual window. So in the actual window, it's going to be that 100 kilowatts that's going to be used for the math, not the average over the full 4 hours. And so you can see the net effect of it is we have that same at the very bottom, 83 times 3 times 4. But then we also have the additional 100 times 3 times 15 times 1 hour where it actually occurred. So on this day, the resource would generate 5.5 clean peak certificates. So effectively, that 1 hour of the month was more or less worth the equivalent of that same resource over about 4.5 days, 4.5 other days of the month. So relative scale, performance against day-to-day for the entire month is still substantially higher overall incentive value, but there is a fairly substantial signal to perform coincident with that actual. So just to highlight something that was included in the statute, there is an opportunity for the DOER to require the electric distribution companies to procure clean peak certificates. And so the opportunity there may give us further flexibility in making sure that our policy objectives are achieved with the rollout of the program. So such a procurement could be established in a similar manner as SMART in the past, which I believe most of you are aware of, which is a tariff-based approach for procuring. In this case, there may be an opportunity for simplicity because it would only be for the certificates. It would not be bundled energy and certificates necessarily. So that may help with simplification. There could also be opportunity for relatively standard form contracts, as we've seen in other states, like ZREC programs. So this is currently under consideration. Again, we need to balance this with an objective to have a promulgated regulation in place by early, by within quarter one of next year. So I do believe we have the statutory capability, but we are seeking feedback on whether to utilize that authority at the moment, and if so, how to. And some additional comments there would be to what scale, what portion of the market would be tied up in procured contracts versus open market trading of minted certificates. And I think an objective that we would like to adhere to would be if we are going to leverage the requirement for procurement, it would be to target target technologies that would be eligible to participate in this program that may not otherwise have access to long-term financing, and where access to a long-term contract for their certificates may make the difference in whether or not they can be built in the Commonwealth. So that would be the type of facility that may provide the most value in providing these long-term contracts, access to these contracts. In reporting requirements, so as I mentioned, we're currently envisioning every resource would have to provide hourly interval data for the entire preceding month. We are currently in the process of evaluating what the platform would look like. Again, this is a bit more complex than past portfolio programs where we've had verification and minting and verification requirements, because there are timestamps now involved and we are working with interval data from every resource. We may establish different metering requirements depending on project size and project technology that may be most visible in demand response as we attempt to establish appropriate measurement and verification for demand response, where today typical demand response performance may be measured against a baseline, whereas in this instance we are looking at daily operation. And so you may have eroded your own baseline that you would otherwise have measured and verified against. And we're currently looking into whether we should contract with a sole metering and data verification provider. Because there are so many different types of technologies that will be participating, we anticipate numerous potential metering schemes to be participating. We do not want the program or for program participants to have different results just because of the metering vendor that they have selected or the metering configuration that they have implemented. Again, in the name of program simplicity and ability to roll out on a fairly quick time frame, a centralized metering and verification provider may be the most appropriate solution at this time. So on tracking and verification process, again, the vendor would receive all of the hourly performance from each resource. The vendor would validate the production of certificates for every resource. The vendor will report on the production. Again, we're currently looking at whether we should seek the services of multiple entities or a single centralized solution for metering and minting certificates, as well as a trading platform for those certificates. We've also had preliminary conversations with the Mass Clean Energy Center about the ability for them to act as the centralized metering and verification provider. They currently provide that for SREC projects and are currently overhauling the production tracking system, so this may be a opportunity for us to leverage that that system. Getting into alternative compliance payment rates, the objective of the program is to have resources design, build, enroll, and participate. And we understand in order to achieve that objective, the revenues must be appropriate for them to go through that process. So that is of core consideration when developing an alternative compliance rate. The way we are currently proposing for the program to be structured would be to have a flat ACP rate for the first 10 or so years, and then have the ACP decline. And the objective there would be multifold. It's a cost containment mechanism for the program. So as we continue to have the obligation increase and have the number of resources increase. Declining the ACP rate helps us to levelize the cost instead of letting the cost escalate indefinitely. The declining ACP would also send a signal that delayed movers are not incentivized over early movers. So we do expect technology costs to decline, and this is one way to incorporate that into the program structure. The other objective with that is it may enable a smooth phase out of the program towards 2051, which is an end date established in statute. I do not think our objective is to have to be involved in flattening the load profile indefinitely. However, this program would help get the resources deployed, get them participating, get them used to responding to price signals, and get them benefiting the Commonwealth, and then being able to phase out this type of program as there are potentially other price signals available to those systems that provide very similar end results to flattening the load profile. So on the scale of the program, cost of the program, this is something where, again, we have consultants currently working on what are required revenue streams for us to expect the developing market to actually build to and operate to. So again, we need to balance our costs and the benefits. As part of Governor Baker's original filing of the program, he included a proposed cost cap of the program of under half a cent per kilowatt hour. We are striving to maintain that cost cap. And that is just the program cost. We are also looking into the benefits, where we are working to try to develop the program so that it is a net benefit to ratepayers as early as possible in the program. So while there would be a cost cap, there is also a lot of benefit to the program that's not necessarily directly, those revenues don't flow directly within the program. The exact values are to be determined on the ACP and on the scale of obligation. And because we are early in the development of a brand new program, there's a lot of flexibility in the structuring of the program, whether on the scale, on the number of certificates being generated by a given resource, and on the value of any given certificate. So again, we will welcome stakeholder feedback. We do value the input, and we really require input from industry to make sure that we are designing a program that will be effective and will work and will be cost effective. So I think this is the last slide we have, and then we'll be transitioning into questions and answers. Our anticipated implementation schedule. So here we are, end of quarter one, releasing the straw proposal. We will be seeking, or we are now actively seeking, written feedback on this. We will be releasing at least the results of our consultant reporting, the results of the analysis, which will be informing obligation scale, ACP rate, and other fairly critical values there. And just one thing to note for everyone as a core part of the analysis, similar to the APS, and again, dissimilar from the RPS, because we will be the first in the nation with the program, there will not at the outset be out of market or other markets to trade these certificates into. So we are doing our best to be very careful about a supply-demand tension to make sure there is not excessive volatility in the market as the market ramps up. So unlike RECs, where they can be traded in other states, there's not currently that opportunity, and there will not be that opportunity early on in this program. So going into quarter two 2019, we'll be receiving feedback. We will be releasing draft regulation for public comment. At that point, there will be substantial detail. It will be in draft reg form. Again, between now and then, we're seeking feedback. As we're drafting the reg, we're seeking feedback. And then we'll be putting that reg out. Following that, we will have public hearings as part of our standard rulemaking process. And then we will be filing the regulation. The objective of all of this is for us to have regulation in place in quarter one, by sometime quarter one of next year, so that the program is up and running before trading begins next year. So in order to do that, we need to have everything in place, structured, and operating before the summer of next year. So this is a fairly quick turnaround in terms of brand new regulation implementation. Next steps, we will be posting the slides to our website. We are seeking feedback. We would like feedback by Friday, April 12th. Again, we have our doors are open, our phones are on. Give us a call. Send us comments, even if you can't make that April 12th. But do your best to be timely, because this is a very fast-moving regulation process. So we look forward to receiving that. Please note that it is DOER that is seeking the feedback, not our consultants. So please do address questions, comments to us, as opposed to our consultant team. And with that, I think we are going to transition to questions from the audience. We have a microphone on the in the aisle. So as people want to come up to the microphone, feel free to ask questions. Thank you. Yes, so the statute does explicitly contemplate TVR, where it says changes in consumption patterns due to time of use rates are considered demand response. The challenge there, as I mentioned, is this is a portfolio, and we will be minting certificates that have a trading value associated with them. So there is a standard of verification that we'll need to have. And so, as an example, it would be difficult for us to know if someone pressed the 3-hour delay on their dishwasher instead of pressing start because they were on a time of use rate, because they've always pressed it, because of this program. So while we would like to incorporate as much cost-effective DR as possible into this program, we may be relatively limited at the outset based on just what there is relative comfort that we can measure and verify and mint certificates on. So definitely a part of it, definitely something that we look forward to evolving, especially as time of use rates maybe become more prevalent, and as understanding of behavioral patterns and understanding of actual attribution of the change to the value stream becomes more apparent. But early in the program, we will need systems that at least can be measured for participation.
Thanks. Dan Alberti, Sigma Consultants. I have two quick clarifying questions. The first is on eligible resources. You indicated that incremental storage at pump storage facilities would qualify. Can I take that to mean that incremental hydroelectric storage that uses conventional storage would not qualify as opposed to pumps?
I may have to get back to you on that.
Okay.
If it's...
We may comment on that.
Yeah, if it's incremental storage, I think reading through the statute, it's fairly clear that incremental pump storage would be eligible. I think that's something that we would need to review. And again, we welcome comment. We recommend that as stakeholders draft their comments, that they review the statute as they draft the comment, because there are certain constraints and certain definitions provided in the statute that may guide your position.
The second question was just on the compliance entities. You indicated retail electric suppliers. Does that include utilities providing basic service or municipal electric light departments?
It does include EDCs providing basic service, and then by statute, MLPs are explicitly excluded.
Once again, thanks.
Yep.
Just to clarify Dan's first question, I get to call that. So if it was RPS eligible, then it would be, it would qualify under that. So if you had incremental existing hydroelectric facility, that should qualify. But RPS eligible does not allow for new mountains or dams constructed after 1997, so there would be some interesting overlap there. So it's a good question.
Currently on. All right. Seth from Source One. A couple questions about MLPs. First question is, what benefit is DOERC to having peaks of time each month as opposed to, for example, 3 hours over the course of each season or something? And then the second question is, whether the peaks are always going to be set based on the Massachusetts overall consumption, as a regular one, or other sub-regions, or how will you consider a location?
Sure, great questions. So to the second question, we are primarily looking at Massachusetts load profiles. And to the establishing windows, the statute did evolve over time as it went through the legislative process. As originally proposed by the administration, the target was going to be the peak 10% of hours through the year. So they would be actual peak periods, whereas where the statute landed, it's fairly clear in reading that we are to establish set windows for each season, and those windows will not vary. So I do think we are relatively limited to a structure pretty similar to the windows that we're proposing here. When those windows occur and how they're divvied, again, is up to our discretion, but the actual implementation of windows that are applicable during the season is fairly clear in statute.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mark Haynes, with Direct Energy. First of all, thank you for a very comprehensive overview of the straw proposal. That was very enlightening. My question really is focused on the annual compliance requirement and the ACP schedule going forward. So from a retail supplier perspective, it's very important to have predictability with respect to those timing. By not having that, it injects risk into the pricing for the end use customer. And I think we're all sensitive to the fact that with that unpredictability, we've seen it in other elements with respect to the SREC program, where it's more of a formula and methodology that oftentimes is very difficult to discern versus something that's predictable, that is put forward either by a 5-year horizon or a life of the program. So we urge the department to think about that with respect to the customer impact with setting that level of annual compliance obligation. Thank you.
Wonderful, yeah. And please also do follow up with written comments as well. They would be welcomed. And to that point, again, one of our goals in structuring this is to make this similar and relatively familiar to past programs to avoid overcomplication and to avoid uncertainty in forecasting program impacts.
Thank you.
Greg Albrecht, National Biofuel Board. First of all, I'd like to give your entire team an A-plus for the work that you've done here. You've done a very great job. So, in terms of the broader societal benefits or benefits to the ratepayers in Massachusetts and across New England, I think especially during the winter time when wholesale prices for power on the Iceland New England grid are very, very sensitive to low and outside temperatures, okay, which then impact the cost of spot market natural gas, which then becomes a major component in the pricing of power. The benefits of relaxing the strain on the system during those peak hours will be huge, okay? I watch the grid pricing every day on my computer at home, and when the New England grid is in the load range of approximately 18,000 to 20,000 megawatts across all six states, the pricing of wholesale power can jump very quickly from, say, perhaps $75 per megawatt hour, which is roughly equivalent to steam cycle, gas-fired power that has come online, can very quickly double to $150. And since that all the generators get paid that same clearing price, there's a huge volume of dollar benefits that the ratepayers are going to so I think it's all the more reason for pushing your program forward. One specific question I have is in the your questionnaire questions that you posed on the website a couple months back, it seemed that one of the questions that you raised was were battery charging, battery storage type systems, would natural gas be allowable to fill the gap in battery charging if those batteries could not be built up through solar, PV, or through wind? And I had offered a comment that you should keep it indeed to pure renewable energy, which could include that renewable fuel-fired power generation. But I'm just wondering internally where you might stand on that. Have you come to any policy decisions? The reason why I ask is natural gas is very difficult to compete with at the pricing that we generally have. So I'm just wondering how you might work upon that.
Sure, yeah. And first, thank you for the feedback on winter. And if you have time available, I highly recommend we released a comprehensive energy plan late last year, which you might enjoy reading through. It does include a detailed look into winter events. For the energy storage, again, the statute is fairly clear that a qualified energy storage resource will serve primarily to store and discharge renewable energy. So I would say while primarily does not necessarily necessitate only renewable energy, it does need to be the primary operation of the system. that raises a few points that didn't come up. One, I think I did flag that energy storage is oftentimes considered a demand response resource, so there is likely opportunity for energy storage to participate as a demand response resource and not even go through the process of demonstrating that is a qualified energy storage resource because it is instead just a demand response resource, which does not have the same limitations and requirements. But we are looking to enable flexibility for the storage locationally and operationally. So I think we are looking for feedback on how a non-co-located storage resource may be able to demonstrate that it is operationally paired or operating in a way that that primarily is serving to charge and discharge with renewable resources or in a manner that enables integration of renewable resources. So, for example, even if it's not the energy necessarily is primarily for renewables, it could be operating in a way to mitigate other concerns from renewables, whether it's voltage concern or other types of issues where the storage deployed is actually enabling further integration of renewables. But that is a component that we need to provide further clarity by the time we have a regulation in place. So we would welcome feedback. The other note there is we did receive quite a few comments that presumed that the energy storage would need to settle RECs for any energy that it charged with. And I think that may not necessarily be a requirement in this program. As I mentioned in the statute, a RPS resource will generate a REC and will generate a clean peak certificate. So it's not having to forego the generation of the REC. So similarly, the other resources wouldn't necessarily need to purchase and settle a REC, which I think is in everybody's best interest, because we are not trying to add new tracking verification to individual RECs to now settle them and tie them to an entirely separate trading program. So I do think that will help with simplicity, but it adds further weight to our requirement to identify what is primarily operating for the storage and discharge of renewables.
Hi, Courtney for the Car Fitness Auditor. I just have a quick clarifying question about for transmission level interconnected resources, can you clarify whether the resources would be physically located in the Isoo New England area or whether it can be delivered to Isoo New England?
I believe that we were looking at it would be interconnected and tied into the ISO New England region. So not that it can, it would not be that it can wheel into ISO New England, but it would be physically tied in. Whether or not the resource would actually be physically located or just electrically connected, I think I do not know necessarily the clarity between those two, though.
Thank you for your comments. This is Jan from Power Energy. A question on when the monthly earthing will be is actually outside of the designation go. How does the certificate calculation work that center be out of 4 hour battery? Do you take a slight hit on the window calculation in exchange for the multiplier calculation?
So as we're currently looking at it, you would not take you would take a hit if you changed your operation within the daily window. So both would still be in effect, both the actual peak and the 4 hour. So essentially there'd be one additional hour of clean peak window in that month because it happened outside of the window. You would still have the seasonal multiplier applied against it, so that would remain the same. And you would still have the calculation of the other 4 hours of that day, which maybe you have reduced your performance during those 4 hours because you have saved charge or otherwise to go after that other 1 hour. So you may be operationally intentionally taking a bit of a hit within that window, but you're not taking a hit in the sense that we're not just going to cut off an hour from the peak window and to say that window shifted for the day. The window would have stayed the same and you're separately receiving that incentive for that your production during the one actual hour.
Since the average of the
9 hours
is
not. No, for your peak window participation, it's your average on the four on the day, and then for your actual, it's your just on that 1 hour.
Okay. And second question,
have you considered a performance multiplier or an annual multiplier? Oh, an annual peak performance multiplier. I would say early in program consideration. We did consider it. I think where we've landed does not have an annual. However, because we have multipliers by season and we have multipliers for actual, and because they would be multiplicative, the end result becomes very similar. And the objective of this program isn't necessarily to reduce just the one peak hour of the year. It really is to shift our load profile to target those peaks, but to do it on a daily basis, not do it on a, we're just resolving a few days of the year. We're trying to more fundamentally shift renewables to meet the peak and reduce those peaks on a day-to-day basis.
Good morning. Thank you very much for your presentation. I'm Paul Dale. I'm with the Massachusetts CRL. I'd like to return to your comments on the procurement slide, where at the bottom it says something about, focus on facility types that may not have other sources of long-term financing, in particular biomass. My question is there anything in the statute that requires you to put special focus or emphasis on, say, biomass facilities, or is that something that DOER, from a regulatory standpoint, consider?
There is nothing in the statute that requires a focus on any given technology within the eligible technologies identified. That said, we do have to recognize the landscape we're operating within, where some resources in this program may have access to policies or programs, incentives or otherwise, that give them a revenue certainty for a fairly substantial amount of their revenue requirement, whereas other technologies may have zero access to long-term revenue certainty. And the difference between those can be substantial in the end result of what's developed and if certain things are developed at all. So I think that's part of the consideration there, would be to make sure that if we were to require procurements, those procurements were serving to do something above and beyond what's already being achieved by the broader program.
Yeah, well, I'll put it in, among other things, in feedback, but do be aware that biomass is not a clean energy source. It is more polluting than many other sources because you're releasing all the stored CO2 when you're burning trees, and trees are the only mechanism that we have that's effective today to sequester. Already admitted, so in a double manual fashion, I would encourage the OER to not take any explicit action to try to encourage biomass, but that would be in a common sense.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Bill Jones, the City of Boston. The cost of the clean peak standard is going to be passed on to ratepayers, and I understand the Department of Energy to make some embarrassing of what those costs are. But one of the benefits of this the standard would certainly be the avoided cost of distribution and transmission. Distribution and transmission. I was wondering if some fair attempt would be made to evaluate the value of those benefits so that consumers have a clearer idea of what the net cost of the standard would be.
Definitely. So I definitely think part of our evaluation approach in developing this is to be as aware as possible of the projected costs and benefits. So we are going to be doing our best to understand the anticipated benefits, because as you mentioned, there are transmission benefits, there are distribution benefits, there may be reducing ICR benefits. The more that we actually shift our load profile and the profiles of our peaks, the more confident anyone that has a role in planning and forecasting system improvements can believe us when we say we're going to start reducing our peaks. So we need to act and actually demonstrate that we'll be reducing our peaks before anyone would believe it and forecast and build based on that. So it can be a bit tricky to analyze when the results of our reducing peaks will actually provide the level of confidence for planners and those responsible for building the system to incorporate the results of the program. However, it's certainly a consideration that we'll be trying to analyze.
Good morning. I'm Paul Craig from the University. Thank you for the presentation. I have two questions, maybe one technical, maybe one slightly philosophical. The first would be based on the slide of the negative multiplier presented. Is it correct that we would be essentially establishing, for lack of a better term, a window outside of the windows, where if a negative peak, your yellow band happened outside? Does the DOER have a jurisdiction to apply negative multipliers outside of windows? How does that work for you essentially?
Right. So I guess we would welcome feedback on it. We have jurisdiction over determining the windows. There are the limitations of the must be at least 1 hour and shall not exceed 4 hours. This would be a minimum load window and not necessarily a peak load window. So I do think there is fairly substantial flexibility in the authorizing statute as to the structure of the program. It could be that the window of the peak windows could be shortened to account for a minimum load multiplier. But again, I guess we would welcome feedback, and it's just an early consideration of how the program can serve to enable the continued integration of renewables, because those renewables need to be integrated before they can then deliver for peak. And we are reaching a number of areas in the state and more regionally where these minimum load periods, which again are very discrete periods, just like the peak is very discrete and very limited number of hours where it occurs, but the impact of that occurrence is substantial. And so the more we can mitigate the impact of the occurrence, we believe the better off everyone will be. So the concept of a...
Just to, I guess, more highly, this seems very good in that it's a peak standard to go after load and emissions. This is only load. So just sort of curiosity, why one was picked up the other from that perspective.
So I would just qualify with emissions. There are a number of accepted ways of calculating emissions. And I would say each of those accepted methods has its drawbacks and has its people that disagree. So it can be very difficult to settle on one in particular. So as you mentioned, going on marginal, I do think a challenge with us sending, a marginal emissions signal would be here we are looking at fundamentally changing a load profile. And so it's not a single marginal impact. It's a stack of marginal that would have otherwise occurred, which gets trickier and trickier as you're no longer just displacing a single dispatch, but an entire plan of how you would dispatch and who you would dispatch and what type of uplift is even required. And it starts changing things beyond just the marginal rate. So I think we would be welcome to consideration. Again, one of our objectives will be relative simplicity and the ability to promulgate in a very timely fashion. So while some of these policy enhancements I think we see value in and we think would provide value to the Commonwealth at large, whether or not they make it in this initial rollout and initial rulemaking remains to be seen.
I'll also just say one comment to see for time. The absence of a clean energy credit having, it seems concerning that is the environmental attribute embodying clean energy credit or co-producing a renewable energy credit, which implies all of the environmental attributes, but then similarly for coincident a clean peak credit. That you seem to establish tension, so the
they have to discharge during the entire 4-hour period, or is less acceptable?
Less would be acceptable. Again, your actual performance would determine your actual incentive. So, for example, if you only discharge during one of the 4 hours, then when you're averaged out over the 4 hours, it's equivalent of substantially less performance. So, again, I think the seasonal multipliers may send a bit of a signal of what seasons you would really want to try and hit all 4 hours and maximize participation, whereas other seasons, there may be other revenue streams that you're pursuing that outweigh performance in this program. So no, partial performance would be acceptable. It remains to be seen, though, if charging on the window would have a negative effect on your production. So for example, if early in the window you discharged at full power and maybe met an on-site demand charge and clean peak window at the same time, that's wonderful. But then if you immediately recharged at full power to try and position yourself for a future potential demand charge moment, now you're charging at full power while we're still within the clean peak window, and that is not wonderful. So there remains to be seen whether that would actually have a negative...
I guess what I'm contemplating for particularly the large storage units that I'm working with that are the ISO New England level, they may want to discharge at 2 hour for 2 hours and completely deplete in 2 hours during that window.
Yeah, so as currently structured, they could completely deplete in 2 hours, and whatever portion of those 2 hours was within the window would be eligible to generate certificates, and they would just have essentially a zero dispatch performance for the remaining hours, and so they would only be paid for what they've actually contributed.
Thank you.
Steve Smith with Emma. I had a question on the monthly peak loads. ISO New England incorporates the load for ISO and does not have a Massachusetts specific load. So I was looking to see how you define a Massachusetts load that is transparent in real time for storage to react to those peaks.
Great point. So for real time, you're correct. We don't have access to real time load flows. We do have 5-minute SMD data that comes out daily and then also monthly, which is broken down all the way down to the load node, but they also then report in the SMD data sets by SEMA, NEMA, Western Mass, and then other parts of ISO. So I think as you, if you look at the data sets, you'll see a 99-point-something% correlation between Massachusetts load profile and New England load profile, especially for peaking. We do represent about half of the load, similarly about half of the peak contribution. And we often have very similar weather to the other primary load pockets of the region. So typically, it's hot here. It's also hot in Hartford. I don't personally know what data source would be available for real-time responsiveness for a participant to be looking at the peak. However, I would say starting with looking at ISO, looking at how that correlates to past data sets of actual Massachusetts versus ISO will give a pretty high level of confidence of what hours you're targeting for.
The second question really is with regards to the transmission peaks from EverSource and National Grid. While they're highly correlated to ISO loads and not perfectly correlated, which peak would you be looking to go after on a monthly peak, assuming that they are not inside that, or even if they're inside that window, whereas the economic benefit is on the transmission peak and not necessarily on your load peak if they are disjointed?
Right, so there are many peaks in our system. As you know, there are from peak regional to peak on any given peak regionally through transmission, peak on an individual transmission line, down to peak on every distribution line. I would say, given the relative bluntness of this instrument of future forecasting, generalized windows, and the objective of overall load profile modification, we'll be looking at the overall peak load of the state and not particular transmission peak necessarily.
Thank you. Yep. Hi, Rob Ashley, CPD. I was curious, since the municipal electric providers aren't required to purchase clean peak certificates, are municipally connected generation resources that meet the criteria allowed to generate CPCs and sell them to the retail electric providers?
That is a very good question, and I think we would welcome comments on that.
Greg Everett, LS, Will, thanks a lot for the presentation and the whole thing. Here we are. Two questions. One is, have you all thought at all about the baselining for demand reductions and how you do the measurement and verification of those resources? We've got, obviously, I assume the programs, we've got utility programs. I'm wondering if you all thought at all about that. The second question is, the legislation that has the term there, energy reserves, which is another real thing, but it has at least the word reserves in there. I'm wondering if you all have considered whether or not the resource that is providing reserves, I assume, would at all qualify. There's not taking a position one way or the other. Just curious what you guys, how you guys can put that first.
All right, I'll try and take those in order. for the DR baseline, I would say I bring that up in every single meeting I have with a third party that I think may have insights. I think Amy and Kara have heard me ask about DR baselines many times over the past few months. We are very interested in solutions. The challenge is, again, we are going to need a data stream that will be uniform enough and acceptable for us to verify performance and mint a certificate based on. And that is challenging. we have been looking into, are there data signals other than meter signals that we could receive? So maybe a centralized platform sent a dispatch signal and received a certain number of pings confirming performance, and maybe that data signal is something that could be verified and could be evaluated on. But otherwise, it is something we're struggling with, and it's something that we would like as much DR to participate as possible, while at the same time understanding that we do want a sound verification process and to be confident in all certificates that we've been. So that's on the DR, and again, we welcome comments on that within this process or outside of it. Anyone that has an idea, something that is worth considering is not only would performance in this start to impact the baseline for assessing performance in this program, if, for example, you have a set of loads that you're participating as DR in a distribution company's demand response program, by performing every day here, you may be changing your baseline for evaluation in other programs. So the DR aspect will be complicated for participants, but for participation and verification's sake, we are seeking simplicity. To the comment on reserves, I do not foresee us tying any eligibility criteria to wholesale market performance. So I do not see us tying a eligibility criteria to a resource being willing or proving that it will participate in reserves. So I do think we will need to be careful in how we review the term. I don't remember precisely where the word reserves was used in statute, but that may be a good opportunity in the comment to point that out and provide potential interpretations there.
Thank you.
Quick question on ownership of certificates. Naturally, you think the owner of the asset will have natural rights to the certificates, but I was mentioning to you about the rights to the environmental attributes, say, the class 1 REX. We want to be able to claim these credits. Is there any guidance to the owner of the REX around that that you can see as far?
Yes. Limited guidance and definitely opportunity for feedback. So we've had a couple questions about considering environmental attributes, considering how a REC may encompass the entirety of the environmental attribute and encompass all attributes. Just generally, this program is basically a pay-for-performance program. It's an incentive to perform at a specific time, whereas typical RECs and most structures of contracts where RECs convey are either bundled energy plus REC or just REC contract, irrespective of the time. So I think there will definitely be consideration required for contracts that may exist where the attributes convey, because if the owner-operator is not receiving the price signal from this program, then they likely haven't changed their operating profile as a result of this program, and so they are just by happenstance generating certificates and not generating certificates in accordance with the objective here, which is receiving the signal and changing output based on the policy signal. So that is definitely something that requires consideration. There are a number of types of contracts in play where RECs convey. So it is worth understanding the landscape there of what types of contracts exist, why they exist, how they're structured, how the attributes are defined, and considering all of that with the rollout of this program. So, again, comments will be are welcome, but it's important when taking a position on that to understand the objective here is for the price signal to make its way down to the organization responsible for the operation of it, because we want the load profile to change, we want the dispatch profile to change as a result of this. And if they have zero visibility into the incentive, then they have zero incentive to change their operation.
And a follow-up question on pricing, dollar amounts. Is there still consideration for your price support mechanism similar to the initial permit? And I guess the reason behind the question is the supply side of this equation would be nearly impossible to project, so price is
I do think that could be on the table. I think comments would be appreciated on that. I do think it would be helpful if the comments were to reference why price floors have been required or implemented elsewhere, the benefits, but then also the potential concerns, because if a certain price is not required for us to achieve the objective, then we do not want to be overpaying in the program. So I think it would definitely require care to structure it appropriately. That said, we do understand the concern of price volatility and potentially devaluing price in pro forma generation because of the uncertainty, especially when you have such a unknown, you have unknowns in supply. I think comments will be welcome, but it would be helpful if the comment was structured in a way to provide sort of the reasoning and appropriate mechanism of setting them.
Louis Ortiz with Embarrick Development Partners. First off, I'd like to thank you, Will, you, ER team, your consultants, for all the work to structure something that isn't necessarily in the statute well-defined or whatever, but kind of bring it together and have discussion. Lots of opportunity for feedback, and you're up here on the hot seat for so long, it's quite a day for you. My question, and I may have a comment afterwards, but a question is it DOER's interpretation that the structure that you described of Fastline Renewables generating RECs and CPCs concurrently, is it your interpretation that that's statutorily required, or is that a program definition that you're seeking feedback on?
I believe the statute is fairly precise and clear in language that it's required that they generate both CPCs and RECs within the window.
Because in general, I could actually see a large state procured renewables that have this, in essence, get this CPC for free, have less incentive to provide storage with it than if the actual assets that would move renewables to the peak periods. And they're going to flood that market with those CPCs that they actually don't need because they're already supported their costs. So, but we'll look at it and see if you have any comments to help out with that or suggestions that might improve.
Thank you. And as you draft those comments, it would be helpful to include consideration of, to the previous question of where contracts are structured, where the RECs already convey, which attributes are already structured to convey. Does the price signal even make its way down to the operator, owner-operator, developer, or just to the contract holder? And if so, does it actually achieve a change in performance as sought by us? So there are multiple interrelated layers to that, and I would say those long-term contracts are just one example of a few that we need to consider all at once.
And I also saw in what you shared this morning an opportunity for procurements being tied to either tariffs or long-term contracts that may help out with that challenge for dedicated pieces versus basically the ones that are getting it for free and how they fit with each other.
Yep.
Maybe you're stepping around here after I knew your last one. Okay. A couple quick questions. One was price floor for for inserts, and whether that was something you're kind of putting similar to what you did, in the ESRA program and the auction on July 31st. And so that might have maybe three questions. That was the first one. I don't know if I answer it. Get the thought clear first, and then I go on to the next.
So actually, we had another price floor question moments ago. So it's definitely something that would be helpful to have in comments, especially. And I mentioned it would be nice to have context of where it has been successful elsewhere, justification for it in other settings and here. And I would say tying it to uncertainty of an unknown generation mix, especially given someone just mentioned potential for other large procurements to be entering the supply mix. So supply questions, and then also because there are no out-of-market trade opportunities, you don't have an effective floor of, say, trading into another state in the region or elsewhere in the country. So providing that context can also be helpful to understand where the comment's coming from.
Second was just an implementation kind of question. So maybe I misunderstood, but it seems like it was a one-month period that you'd be looking at in terms of looking at and then verifying and meeting them, or is it more of a month plus? Or so I wonder if you just go over that a little bit.
Yeah, so the thinking is, I would say details to be determined and welcome feedback. Probably a number of days into the month, say on the 10th or the 15th of a month, a centralized verifier would receive the full interval sets for every resource from the previous month. And so at that point in time, everyone's actual performance is determined. They did whatever they did, and they have the measurements to verify it. Our actual load profile in the state is known at that point in time, so it's much easier than to just assess against the entire data set of every individual resource's performance and certificate generation against the windows, against the actual peak, and it will also supply us with a fairly substantial database to start assessing the successes of the program and start evaluating actual benefits as they accrue.
But you don't have a time period like right now when you would sit with the expert partner. You got a month plus, you know, 15 days or website quarter.
We don't have that yet. I think that would be part of the determination of to go to a centralized platform, whether it's an existing platform or a new platform. So I think the timeline would be tied to the capabilities of the platform that we would go to. If there are implications associated with the timing, financial, operational, or otherwise, it would be great for us to hear about that in the comments so that we understand that as we proceed with identifying an appropriate platform and vendor.
And the last thing that should be segued right into the next one, which was you talked a little bit about maybe using the TTS system. I don't know if third-party verification is also involved in that. That might help, especially when you have, you have some cats here you got herd together that may come in, but you need them to be, obviously, to be consistent and sort of reliable.
Exactly. So the goal, as you mentioned, consistency and reliability. There may be an opportunity for third-party verification. As noted elsewhere, metering requirements may vary by technology type or project size. So similarly, whether or not third-party verification is allowed could also be tied by resource type or resource size, because there may be fairly simple project types that are fairly easy to meter and verify, whereas there may be others that may be very complex, and we only want one person or one entity determining what the appropriate metering scheme is for that complexity. So I do think there remains the opportunity for third-party metering and verification. However, with the goal of rapid procurement of any vendors, procurement of any platform requirements, determinations, and a very fast rulemaking and standing up the program, simplicity will be key. So comment would help in making that determination of whether third-party verification is worthwhile to enable for certain technologies, or whether a single metering and verification entity might be more appropriate at this point, with the potential to open it in the future.
Great, thank you.
Yep. I think we have the room for a few more minutes, but seeing no one else at the mic, I'd like to thank everyone for coming in today. I hope this has been helpful. Again, we look forward to hearing your comments, and you will be hearing from us in the near future as we continue to develop this program and implement this exciting regulation. Thanks.